Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A liquefied natural gas project along the Delaware River in New Jersey took a step forward this week with an assist from the first state.
What they concluded was that the project would indeed have no substantial impact on the water resources of the basin.
Contributor John Hurdle dissects the Delaware River Basin Commission's approval of this nearby LNG dock project. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also highlight a new project coming to Wilmington's West Side that offers affordable apartment living for adults with disabilities. Arts Playlist tells us how the historic Odessa Foundation is changing up its annual holiday celebration. And Enlighten Me takes us to the Brandywine Zoo to check out changes there. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A controversial effort to build a dock along the Delaware River in Gibbstown, New Jersey, to export liquefied natural gas moved closer to fruition this week with a little help from the first state. The Delaware River Basin Commission gave its final approval for the plan Wednesday, with Delaware providing one of the yes votes. The approval comes in the face of strong opposition from a variety of environmental groups and some local governments, including some in Delaware. Contributor John Hurdle has more on this week's vote and the opposition to the proposed LNG operation in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to walk us through the issues. For those who haven't been paying close attention to this LNG dock project in New Jersey, can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of what the plan is, what it involves?
Sure. So this is a plan to ship liquefied natural gas from a place called Wyalusing in northeastern Pennsylvania, about 175 miles south to this new export terminal at Gibbstown in New Jersey. And the shipment would be made via truck or train. The operator got a special permit from the federal government last year for the nation's first LNG by train transportation. And the larger context here is that the raw material here would be natural gas that's taken from Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale, which is one of the largest natural gas reserves in the world. But the development of it has been held back in recent years by low domestic prices and by a shortage of pipelines to take the gas to market, and so this project, the Gibbstown project, would be a way of finding overseas markets for that gas.
And specifically, this is a dock that's being built along the Delaware River that would take that liquefied natural gas, put it on boats, and then send it out via this port to, as you mentioned, places around the world.
Correct.
So what was at stake at this week's Delaware River Basin Commission vote? Why did it draw so much attention in terms of what it meant to this project?
Well, the first thing, in terms of the amount of attention it drew, it should be noted, first of all, that the opponents, the environmental groups that opposed this plan, managed to gather something like 100,000 signatures from all four basin states, including Delaware. So there was a great deal of public opposition to this. So the DRB, their jurisdiction covers the dredging of the river and the construction of the dock at Gibbstown. And the reasons that it drew so much attention were several. One is that it would be, or perhaps now will be, New Jersey's first liquefied natural gas export terminal. There aren't very many of these in the United States. The only other one, I mean, most of them are on the Gulf Coast, the Gulf of Mexico coast. There's one at and off the coast of Maryland. So this would be the first one in New Jersey. Another reason that this was so galvanizing for the environmental community is that they said that the production of natural gas would increase carbon emissions, which of course In the context of that, that all of the basin states at the moment are actually trying to reduce their contributions to climate change. And the other reason is that DRBC had previously approved this project. They approved it in June of 2019, but then they put that decision on hold to allow Delaware Riverkeeper Network, the environmental group that led opposition to this, to allow DRN to argue why it should not take place. And so, of course, the environmental groups were hoping that the DRBC would reverse itself. Obviously, that hasn't happened.
And just to quickly note for people, the membership of the DRBC, you mentioned four states. There's Delaware, there's New Jersey, there's New York, and Pennsylvania, correct?
Correct. Plus, there's the federal government, which is represented by the Army Corps of Engineers.
So tell us a little bit about what the DRBC did say in approving this project. Why did they kind of affirm the decision that they made earlier?
Well, what they concluded was that the project would indeed have no substantial impact on the water resources of the basin, which is what the DRBC is required by law to sustain. And they also concluded that Delaware Riverkeeper Network had not met its burden of proving why the commission should reverse its previous decision.
Now, there are a number of different issues that have been raised by the opponents of this project, including the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. You've alluded to some of them. Just tell us a little bit about what some of these different arguments are.
Well, one of the arguments is that it would endanger public safety. And so what the opponents say is that you would have a kind of around-the-clock procession of trucks and or trains carrying a highly explosive cargo through densely populated parts of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and they argue very strongly that this would be an accident waiting to happen, that there could be actually mass casualties if there is any kind of a derailment of the trains or any of these trucks crashes, and there could be huge explosions. So public safety is one of their arguments. There's also an argument that the process of constructing the dock would be environmentally damaging. So that would involve dredging an area of the river just off South Jersey. And it would also involve stirring up toxic sediment, which has been deposited there by various industrial activities, including a DuPont munitions plant, which used to occupy the site where this new port is being built. And then, of course, there is the objection, as we were mentioning briefly earlier, about how the stimulation of natural gas production would actually increase climate emissions.
As you mentioned, a number of groups in the first state were among those opposed to this. Who was lined up against this project, and what were the arguments that they were kind of seizing on to say, we're not interested in this going forward?
Well, one of them was Wilmington City Council, which overwhelmingly passed a resolution earlier this month on the basis that the shipment of these highly explosive cargoes in large ships would actually pass pretty close to downtown Wilmington, within a mile or two of downtown Wilmington. Densely populated areas of northern Delaware, and they argued that this could be a threat to public safety. We also had objections, very detailed objections from the Newcastle County Civic League, which kind of made the same argument about proximity to population centers, particularly for environmental justice communities, and also that there would be no benefit to Delaware. They argued that That this export operation would, of course, benefit the operator and its investors, but there wouldn't be any benefit to Delaware. And we also had representations from the League of Women Voters of Delaware, and they argued that there had been no study on the impacts that this project would take, impact on public health, public safety, and the environment. And they also said that it would conflict with one of the missions of DENREC, which is to develop clean sources of energy.
You mentioned that the public safety issue, and that makes sense when you talk about the trains and the trucks going through Pennsylvania and New Jersey. You do mention about the possibility of an accident waiting to happen. Just to give people a little context, how close is this to Delaware that it would create a potential public safety threat for Delaware?
Well, the terminal is about 6 miles from the nearest point in Delaware, and the opponents argued that under the right weather conditions, that any spill in the Delaware River / Bay at that point could result in a sort of toxic plume of this of LNG getting blown towards Delaware shores, and they also argued that the Commodore Barry Bridge is less than 3 miles from Delaware's border, and that's the route that the trucks would take to carrying the LNG to the Gibbstown terminal.
You also know that there's some argument for another delay in making this decision in hopes that a new Biden administration might make a difference in the result. What was the argument there?
Well, President-elect Biden has made it plain that he's going to take the climate change a lot more seriously than the Trump administration, and so the opponents of this hoped that delaying a decision by the DRBC would allow the Biden the incoming Biden administration to let's say exert its influence on the DRBC. Of course, the federal government is represented on that commission by the Army Corps of Engineers, and so it was conceivable that some influence might be brought to bear, and it may yet be that that climate policy that the DRBC, or let's say the Army Corps, would vote differently in a different context, but in this matter, that's not the case.
DRBC approval was really the last major obstacle for this project to clear. What, if any, remained to this actually coming to fruition?
Well, there are a couple of minor permits which are still necessary at the state level, specifically by New Jersey. That there is the possibility that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will require a review, and that is that's an argument that's being pursued by Delaware Riverkeeper Network, and the other avenues of redress here, from their point of view, is that DRN is appealing certain permits that have already been granted by the New Jersey environmental officials, plus the Army Corps of Engineers, and I think that they're pinning most of their hopes on that they're going to appeal this in federal court, and their main goal here is to obtain an injunction from at the federal court level against the DRBC decision that would hold this project up.
So you've been watching this process unfold for a while now. From where you're sitting, does it feel like this project is now pretty likely to happen?
I think it does. I think that the various appeals that I just mentioned are probably hopes rather than realistic prospects. There does seem to be a pretty good chance that Delaware River Partners will be able to begin construction within the next 30 to 60 days. And the other thing to note here is that they would be under some time pressure to do so because construction would be is not permitted after March 15th, or there is a window starting on March 15th when construction is not permitted because there are federal regulations against that protect various, for a couple of very rare fish species in the river, and that's when those species would breed, and therefore any construction that would disturb that would not be allowed during that period. And so if the company is going to get this moving soon, then they will have to do so before then.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. His piece on the Delaware River Basin Commission's approval of the controversial LNG export dock along the Delaware River is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with more on a new project moving forward on Wilmington's west side and how it fits into ongoing efforts to revitalize that neighborhood. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. An effort to bring affordable housing for people with disabilities to Wilmington's west side, along with some new businesses, is moving forward. Contributor Larry Nagengast tells us more about the project and the push to complete the vision of a local pastor who set it in motion in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to detail what he learned. So the one specific piece we are talking about is Solomon's Court. Can you give us an overview of what the Solomon's Court project is, where it's located, where it kind of fits in here?
Okay, well, as for the location, now, you know, if you're driving between downtown Wilmington and, say, Kirkwood Highway or Hokesson, chances are you're going to find yourself on 4th Street. That's a broad four-lane artery, and it's lined with aging row homes, corner stores, some ethnic eateries, and a couple of fairly prominent stone churches. About midway through this stretch on the west side, about halfway between Union Street and I-95, is the corner of 4th and Rodney Street. And at that corner on the south side of 4th Street, there's a little park, and that's a kind of a story in itself, and a string of vacant lots that stretch for about half a block. And Solomon's Court is soon going to rise on those vacant lots. It's an interesting project. It's really the first significant new development in this particular area in about 20 years. And community leaders are hoping that Solomon's Court will become a neighborhood anchor, you know, halfway between the Latin American Community Center near I-95 and the Westside Health Center, which is up at the corner of 4th and Scott in the other direction. Looking ahead, they hope that Solomon's Court will trigger even more redevelopment in the blocks on either side.
And as you point out in your piece, it was the brainchild of the late pastor Lottie Lee Davis, who sadly died in an auto accident in September. Can you tell us a little bit about what her overarching vision was for this project?
Well, Pastor Lottie, as she was known in the community, had led the Be Ready, Jesus is Coming Church, which is on the other side of Rodney Street from this project, for about 15 years. And she took over the church from her mother, who had been the pastor. Pastor Lottie made it her mission to strengthen the community around the church. She wanted to help the people in the area find jobs and to make the neighborhood a pleasant place to live. And the park and Solomon's Court are part of that.
And so how did she kind of get this all started? I mean, it's been in the works for a while now, correct?
Yes, it has. And, well, first of all, Pastor Lottie was the spark behind that little park across the street. She helped transform it from a hangout for drug dealers and prostitutes into a pleasant place for kids to play while their parents would watch. And when she saw the buildings on those now vacant lots across the street from the park falling apart, she led an effort to have those buildings torn down. And a nonprofit that she created, the Be Ready Community Development Corporation, acquired the land, and it developed the plans for this commercial residential project, and she then went to work securing the financing to get it started. So she was pulling these pieces together over the last 6 or 7 years, and unfortunately did not live to see it come through.
And like most projects, it's going to come out in phases, specifically two phases. Can you tell us what's up first and then what's going to happen after that?
Okay, well, you know, the first phase of Solomon's Court will have 4,600 square feet of street-level commercial space. Now, that should be enough room for three or four shops or offices. And upstairs, there will be six affordable rental apartments. And then there will be 12 more apartments that are going to be added in the second phase of the project. And through a partnership with the United Cerebral Palsy Organization, many of those apartments are going to be rented to adults with physical disabilities. Now, construction of the first phase of this project should start in a couple of weeks, hopefully by the end of the year, and should take about a year to complete. And then after that, work on the second phase should start. And so we're probably looking at sometime in 2022, 2023 before it's all done.
So how does this particular project fit in with the kind of overall vision for revitalizing Wilmington's West Side?
Well, okay, well, Pastor Lottie, who I first talked to about this project actually about 2 years ago, and her brother, Wayne DeShields, who is guiding it now, were quick to share the credit for the movement here with West Side Grows Together. And West Side Grows Together is the umbrella community organization that is trying to implement this comprehensive plan for revitalizing Wilmington's entire West Side. And we're talking here about the area west of I-95, bordered by Pennsylvania Avenue on the north and Lancaster Avenue on the south. Now, it's an interesting little area. It's got some popular neighborhoods, Little Italy, Cool Spring, Tilton Park, and it's got some major landmarks as well, the Latin American Community Center, St. Francis Hospital, St. Anthony's Catholic Church. The West Side Grows Together initiative has shown the neighborhoods, the people that live in them, that they can get a lot more done by working together than by trying to go it alone.
And in your piece, you highlight there are some other projects that are sprouting up there, kind of concurrent with this Solomon's Court project. Let's start with one of them, Lifelines 3. What is that project all about?
Okay, well, Lifelines is a project that got started about 15 years ago through Paul Calistro, who's the longtime director of the West End Neighborhood House, to help young men and women who are aging out of the state's foster care system. You know, they're typically 18 or 19 years old. They aren't always ready to go to work full time, and they're looking for a safe place to live. Lifelines provides them with housing, job training, and instruction in day-to-day living skills. Now, this latest project, Lifeline 3, consists of building two new townhouses, rehabbing five other homes that are already part of the program, and turning an old pub into a drop-in resource center that will increase Lifeline's housing capacity from 23 people up to 33. And this $2 million project started last month, and it should be completed in about a year.
You also note that there are some other projects that are sprouting up in that area from familiar names, the Latin American Community Center, and what we've talked about previously, the Woodlawn Trustees. Can you fill us in on where those things are at right now?
Okay, well, first, the LACC, the organization has been around for about 50 years, and it's been, for a long while, a major provider of child care in the area, especially for the Spanish-speaking community. Now, they're planning to build a new child care center that could serve 78 more children. That would increase their capacity for serving infants and preschoolers from 136 children up to 214. Now, they've got to raise about another $3 million to get this project started, but they hope to do that fairly quickly and expect that the project will begin late next year and wrap up sometime in 2023. Now, on the other end of the West Side, between Union Street and the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad tracks, the Woodlawn Trustees are halfway through their rebuild of the flats. And as you mentioned, we did talk about that a year or so ago. They're tearing down more than 400 of these century-old rental units, and they're replacing them with 450 new apartments and townhouses. The 77 most recently completed units should be rented by the end of the year, and work on another 52 units should start in the spring. So they're about halfway done with the project. The overall initiative is going to take another 5 or 6 years, but I can tell you from driving by there that the completed sections along Union Street have already given this whole area a very fresh, modern look.
So taking all of this together, does it seem like this work on the west side is really gained some momentum? And is there anything from the way the west side has done things that offers a lesson for similar efforts elsewhere?
Well, you know, I've been following developments on the west side for 7 or 8 years now, and a lot of things have been happening. Now, it's not always going on a set timeline, but it's, for example, some of the things we've seen, new facades and security cameras on businesses in Little Italy, improvements at several parks, mural projects and other beautification efforts, help for business startups, adjustments to traffic patterns on Union Street. I mean, there's a lot more work to be done. And I think it's fair to say, and from what I've seen, that, you know, the areas that were the least attractive in that general vicinity 5 or 6 years ago are probably still the least attractive ones now. But nonetheless, West Side Grows Together seems to me to be far more effective than the former Wilmington Renaissance's organization's effort to develop what they called a creative district on the edge of downtown Wilmington, or the several efforts that have been going on in the last decade to redevelop portions of Wilmington's east side, just to the east of the downtown area. You know, and the key here is West Side Grows Together is living up to its name. It's showing that the little people can get things done when they partner, that they do have the ability to tap into banks and foundations to secure funding, that you can make a difference without having big developers like the Buccini-Pollin Group, who are working on Riverfront and Market Street, being part of your projects. I mean, it's tough. It's tough work. Sometimes it's a real slog. But, you know, working together and working persistently can make a difference. And from listening to the people on the west side, I think it's fair to say that you feel much better when you're part of the solution instead of having someone else doing the work for you.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on the Solomon's Court project on Wilmington's west side is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist, where we hear about how the Historic Odessa Foundation is changing its annual holiday celebration in the face of COVID-19. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Historic Odessa Foundation is breaking from its tradition of hosting guided indoor holiday tours this Christmas due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But there is seasonal sparkle to be seen outdoors as thousands of lights adorn the historic houses of Odessa for visitors to enjoy walking through the grounds. The Historic Odessa Foundation's Executive Director, Debbie Buxton, joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele on this week's Arts Playlist to tell us about Look for the Light, Odessa at Night.
Hey, it's been a long couple of months because of COVID-19. Talk to us about the exciting things happening at the Historic Odessa Foundation and the Historic Houses of Odessa for the holiday season.
Well, we're very excited, Kelly. This is going to be a great year. You know, it's a departure from what we normally do in the buildings, but because of COVID, we're unable to do guided tours through our historic houses. So we decided to do guided tours of the exterior of the houses. So we've lit them all up in beautiful thousands of white lights. This has never been done before, and it really should be spectacular. The lights, they'll be on every night through January 3rd from 6 p.m. until about 11 o'clock at night. We own 6 major buildings, a half a dozen outbuildings, and about 72 acres of property in the historic center of Odessa. So it really should be a dramatic show.
Yeah, I think so, too. And what better way to keep people safe? I mean, you'll be outside. Of course, people will still have to social distance, I'm sure.
Correct.
And still wear masks, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yes.
So on this walking tour and all of these lights, what can we expect to see?
Well, they're just beautiful. We have everything lit up from the smokehouse to the muskrat skinning shack to the doghouse. It's just really delightful. And then, of course, our spectacular Corbett Sharp House, which is a National Historic Landmark building and also a National Park Service Network to Freedom site, will be completely outlined in white light. It is the most beautiful Georgian mansion in the state of Delaware. It is truly an architectural wonder. It's just beautiful. And it'll be more beautiful when it's completely lit this way. We're really looking forward to this. It's not something that we traditionally do, but we wanted to send a message to our community of good tidings and cheer for the holiday season and hope and happiness for the new year. We asked all of our sponsors who normally sponsor our large-scale events like Brewfest and our holiday tour, and they were willing to come together this year to do this lighting show. Normally they, you know, they sponsor our Brewfest and you know, other programs. So we really thank them for coming forward and be willing to, you know, to foot the cost of doing this really for the MOT community and the state at large.
Now, I have to ask because, I mean, the property surrounding the Historic Odessa Foundation and the Historic Houses of Odessa, I mean, it's just so pretty, so beautiful up there. And I'm sure with all the lights, it's even more beautiful. Why have you guys never done this before, even pre-COVID?
Well, we are a colonial site primarily. And, of course, in the 18th century, Christmas was just a religious observance. There wasn't the same celebration of Christmas that comes much later in the Victorian period. It's really the Victorians that capitalize and begin to market Christmas as the holiday that we know it today. So we don't want to lead our visitors to believe that Christmas was ever celebrated in that way by the families who built these wonderful buildings. So every year we make a complete departure from our 18th, early 19th century interpretation, and we recreate a storybook in one of the houses because these families were Quakers, and the Quakers really didn't celebrate Christmas. So in order to bring Christmas cheer, we have to sort of take a leap away from what is historically accurate.
All right. Also happening this holiday season, Historic Odessa will be setting up, I'm told, a recycled holiday ornament resale shop. Tell me all about this.
Oh, it's wonderful. Well, we've always done it for Christmas in Odessa one day only, and it raises a little money for our school tour programming. We do serve about 4,500 school children every year. Of course, this year, where we haven't had the children there because of the virus, but we're looking forward to welcoming them back hopefully by next fall or next spring. But we also offer scholarships. So this little store funds the scholarships for children to come and visit Historic Odessa. So this year we decided, since we're closed inside, to open our wonderful little Colin Sharp House that dates to 1700. Fabulous little building. We do have COVID restrictions. You must wear a mask. We only allow a limited number of people into the building at a time. And we have all these wonderful vintage Christmas tree decorations and ornaments and exterior decorations. We ask the public to donate. They've come forward. We have a whole little house filled up with all kinds of Christmas stuff. And the shop will be open every day, Tuesday through Saturday, from 10 until 4, and on Sunday from 1 until 4. And you can just go to the shop and you know, walk right in and have a look around. There's so much stuff. I've already bought like 5 things.
Well, you know, you have to get before, while the getting's good, I guess.
Well, it's at 2nd Street, right behind our Cantwell's Tavern. So, you know, please do stop in and have a look around.
All right. Just to remind everybody, we're talking to Debbie Bucks, and Debbie is the executive director of the Historic Odessa Foundation. We're talking to her about the Historic Odessa Foundation's Look for the Light, Odessa at Night, light display, and all other holiday events. Debbie, how can people get information, and how will the tickets be done for this? Will they be time tickets?
Actually, this is free to the public. People can drive through town or they can come and walk around our grounds. We're happy to have them do that, providing they're wearing masks and they're observing social distancing. Now, we do offer the walking tours on the evenings on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 5:30. You have to call for a reservation. They can call us at 302-378-4119, or they can visit our website, www.historicodessa.org.
At the very beginning of this interview, you kind of gave us some background about the historic houses of Odessa, but talk to us in more detail for those who are not familiar.
Well, Odessa is one of the most pristine colonial townscapes in the Mid-Atlantic. It's a wonderful little town. Time stood still there, beginning in the mid-19th century. It was a port town. They shipped 400,000 bushels of wheat out of the little town of Odessa in the 18th century. At that time, it was known as Cantwell's Bridge. The railroad bypassed Odessa in the mid-19th century, and so Odessa's sea trade fell off, and the town began a slow economic decline. By the Great Depression, the town had really fallen into grave disrepair, but we were fortunate to be rescued by a gentleman named H. Rodney Sharp, who had first been introduced to Odessa in 1900 as the school teacher in the old academy building there. He taught school for 3 years, moved on to the DuPont Company as an assistant to Pierre Samuel DuPont, eventually married his sister, Isabella, and came back years later when the Corbett Sharp House was put up for sale and began his restoration of the town of Odessa. He restored 19 properties in historic Odessa. It's a wonderful town, rich in Delaware history. We have a collection of over 7,000 decorative arts that were made and used in the Mid-Atlantic area, many of them in the town of Odessa by artisans that live there. One of Delaware's most prominent cabinet makers lived and worked in Odessa in the 18th century. Also one of Delaware's most prominent clockmakers. Great place to visit.
Debbie, I feel like you could go on forever about this.
I could.
You're very passionate.
I absolutely could. We are passionate about it.
The Historic Odessa Holiday Season 2020 is here. Look for the light, Odessa at Night. Anything else I'm not asking that you want the general public to know about for the holiday season?
No, I think I've pretty much covered everything. Make a reservation at Cantwell's Tavern, come down, have a meal, take a walk around, and really enjoy the holidays with Odessa.
Thanks to Historic Odessa Foundation Executive Director Debbie Buxton and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. Again, Look for the Light, Odessa at Night is underway. It runs every night from 5 to 10 p.m. through January 3rd. More information is available at historicodessa.org. And we close out this week's edition of The Green next with Enlighten Me and a trip to the Brandywine Zoo to learn about recent changes there. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. 2020 has been a challenging year, especially for Delaware's visitor attractions. One attraction fought through setbacks and ever-changing guidelines to pursue its expansion plans while simultaneously looking out for the health and safety of visiting families, as well as its animals, including those added as part of a new exhibit. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media contributor Mark Fowler takes us to the Brandywine Zoo.
Near the start of the pandemic about 9 months ago, the Brandywine Zoo broke ground on its Madagascar exhibit, and now it's open. Delaware Natural Resources Secretary Sean Garvin spoke at the exhibit's recent ribbon-cutting event, with very few people present while others looked in via YouTube.
In October, we welcomed 3 radiated tortoises, with 1 from Seneca Park Zoo and 2 from the Miami Zoo. 4 ringtail lemurs from the Bronx Zoo, 2 black and white ruffed lemurs from the Duke Lemur Center, and 1 male and 1 female crowned lemur from the Duke Lemur Center.
The male and female crowned lemurs come as a breeding recommendation from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and the hope is to have baby lemurs for visitors to enjoy. The entire exhibit covers about 4,000 square feet and cost $3.5 million to build. Money came from the state's bond bill and a matching grant from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Along a walkway that goes up and around the exhibit, visitors young and old are entertained by the lemurs in particular as they walk, run, and climb ropes and trees while interacting with each other. Zoo Director Brent Spencer.
One of the things we were trying to do is make it so that we have multiple viewing areas. Each viewing area is a little bit different. You can see the waterfall or hear the waterfall or possibly both. We have animals that will sit up high, sit down low, so no matter where you are, you should have a good view of an animal in the exhibit.
It also includes informational displays about the wildlife and why they're endangered.
It's a good exhibit for people that it should be active. There should be animals moving around all the time. It's a good educational opportunity, and it's a good conservation opportunity. Madagascar is one of the poorest countries in the world, and a lot of the conservation issues that are affecting Madagascar are things that we can impact here in Delaware. For example, vanilla comes from Madagascar. Madagascar is the largest producer of vanilla. So when you buy vanilla for baking, you should buy something that's responsibly sourced and they're not cutting down rainforest, which is where these lemurs live.
Spencer adds the exhibit's inhabitants are here thanks to the collaborative nature of the zoo community nationwide.
These are all captive-born animals. Mm-hmm. As a zoo that's accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, we participate in SSP, Species Survival Plan, programs. And so we're able to move animals back and forth between the zoos. And so when we decided to put this exhibit together, we reached out to the AZA and the various SSPs and said, this is what we'd like to do, and they were able to provide animals for us. So they came from a number of other American zoos.
Mark Schaefer's tenure as executive director of the Delaware Zoological Society has coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic, which forced the zoo to close for a while and then reopen in a COVID-19 world. The Madagascar exhibit faced a brief setback, but it's a key attraction now as the zoo again welcomes visitors with new procedures in place. For example, you can't just show up at the gate.
Back in the good old days, which would have been a year ago, people could just come in without making a reservation. We could welcome them very naturally, but because of COVID, we need to make sure we have the right number of people in the zoo at any particular time. So we limit to 150 people per, we call it a pulse, which is a time block within the course of a day. We have 2 for the most part, at morning and afternoon. And people have been very respectful of that. So we've been able to manage the capacity naturally through the time reservation systems that we've incorporated this year.
Spencer says they have taken other measures to keep people socially distanced and safe.
We were closed for a while. We opened up again in June. We're opening up with limited capacity. We disinfect touch points. We require people to wear masks. We ask for social distancing, and we have markers on the ground indicating what social distance looks like here at the zoo.
Masks are required to be worn by anyone age 5 or older, and they are strongly encouraged for children between 2 and 5. A recent popular zoo activity provided encouragement to move forward, says Schaefer.
But people have been very compliant and very appreciative. In fact, we did a boo at the zoo, which is a Halloween trick-or-treating for young kids. Mm-hmm. And we modified it this year. Years past, it would be an evening event, and then maybe up to 450 people at a time congregating. Because of COVID and other reasons, we made some changes. We made a 3-day event. It was so popular, we added a 4th day during the day with timed intervals for coming in. And the feedback, I just looking at the survey results we got today, people were remarkably happy with the safety protocols we put in place, with the timed intervals. That really meant a lot to people. The feedback was spectacular. So I think we learned a lot from that experience.
Spencer agrees the COVID-19 protocols in place seem to give people confidence about visiting the zoo.
Because we restrict our numbers, we really strive to make sure that we provide that good family safe space. And actually our attendance has been pretty good since we reopened. People know that this is a safe place to come, so they feel comfortable coming here.
The Madagascar exhibit is already one of the largest display habitats at the zoo, but the construction continues. Schaefer says a center for quarantining and taking care of animals is being built, and the front of the zoo is being overhauled as part of the Brandywine Zoo's master plan.
It just means that the Brandywine Zoo is really on an upswing. The accomplishments of this, the joy it's going to bring for years is really rewarding. But it doesn't stop there. We're building the animal services building, which will be more behind the scenes than not for many guests. But guests will be able to tour it. But we're also in the process of a new capital campaign for the front of the zoo, where we're doing a $5 million capital improvement, where we're going to be building a South American wetlands with flamingos and punas, and that's going to increase the footprint of the zoo by another 20%. So again, it's just a very important step in the progress of building a more sustainable zoo going forward. We're very excited about that.
Governor John Carney is also excited. Carney lives in Wilmington, and he was called the zoo's biggest fan by DenRec Secretary Sean Garvin. But Carney says the zoo is just one piece of what makes Wilmington's Brandywine Park special.
This park is such an incredible asset for all neighborhoods in our city, not just the neighborhood up the hill where I live. It's great to have this park and all the beautiful things here right in my backyard, if you will, and I don't have to cut the grass or rake the leaves. But it serves that purpose for every neighborhood, frankly, in our city and neighborhoods across Newcastle County.
If you plan to visit, remember that the Madagascar animals are native to a subtropical climate and will be brought inside to a holding area when the temperature falls below 45 degrees. Mark Fauser, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to contributor Mark Fauser for enlightening us this week. The Brandywine Zoo is open daily, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Non-members need to purchase time tickets online. Members can visit anytime, except for special events like this weekend's Santa visit. Those events require everyone to register for a time to visit the zoo so it can control the number of people on the grounds and maintain social distancing. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Mark Fauser, John Hurdle, and Larry Nagengast, as well as Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. Hi, I'm Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne, host of The Green. Thanks for listening to the show this week. I just want to take a moment right now to remind you that Delaware Public Media is in the midst of its year-end fund drive, and we still need your support for The Green and all of our local news coverage. We're proud of The Green. It's won local and national awards for bringing you stories and interviews focused solely on the First State. Our staff and contributors cover a wide spectrum of topics and issues, ranging from politics and the environment to education and the arts. And it's become even more crucial this year as we've taken in-depth looks at issues associated with the COVID-19 pandemic and protests over racial justice, and covered, of course, the 2020 election here in the First State. But none of this happens without you, the public in Delaware Public Media. If you value The Green and what it brings to you each week and want to keep it going, please take some time to show it by supporting our year-end fund drive. And this is a great time to do so. If you give now, your contribution can double thanks to Newsmatch, which is matching all contributions between now and the end of the year up to $11,000. And we haven't hit 11K yet, so you can help us hit that goal. Just head to DelawarePublic.org right now and click the donate button. Your contribution goes right to what you hear on Delaware Public Media, including The Green. But we need your support right now during this fund drive. So head to DelawarePublic.org and donate. And again, thank you for listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media.